Welcome to this Freshfields podcast, which is part of our Rewarding Half Hour series, brought to you by the Freshfields Reward Team. I'm Alice Greenwell, and today we are talking about transatlantic reward issues, picking up on the ongoing debate about UK versus US pay practices. I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague Regina Erie. Regina has been part of the Freshfields team here in London for a number of years, but is particularly well placed to discuss this topic, as she is in fact New York law qualified and practiced in the US before crossing the Atlantic.
Thank you, Alice. And I'm really happy to talk about a topic that is a particular interest of mine with all the cross-border activities that we have been seeing in recent years. We are seeing media coverage around executive compensation levels in the UK and the US, with some of those reportings advocating for more generous US-style approach in the UK, and the others warning against that level of generous executive compensation. And I think the issue has become much more pertinent in recent years with growing executive mobility and also broader global footprint of many companies.
I think it's absolutely right that the debate has focused on the difference in pay levels, or at least the perceived difference in pay levels between the UK and the US. But I think it's fair to say that when you compare and contrast the UK and the US regimes, it's more than about just pay levels. There are key differences in structure as well. And it's those structural issues that we want to focus on today.
Yeah, that's definitely right. And also, I think it's important to remember that while much of the debate around the US and the UK executive compensation has been within the listed company environment, listing venue is only one of many factors that can affect the executive compensation levels and also the structure. I can think of a number of factors that are relevant here, and they include things like tax implications, the nature of the shareholder base. So, for example, a London-listed company might have more US-based shareholders and vice versa. The business footprint of the company, the country of its incorporation, where the executives are based, and also the applicable employment law that arises from that. So when we talk about US practices and UK practices, we need to remember that we're using those terms quite loosely, and we're not necessarily talking about the listing venue.
Totally agree. So, Regina, thinking about the differences that we see between the UK and the US, what do you think drives the main differences in structure?
Well, it's hard to discuss US executive compensation without talking about 409A. 409A is one of the sections of the US Internal Revenue Code. It has a significant impact on the structure of executive pay in the US. Some of those implications can be quite counterintuitive and also very difficult to grasp. When I'm grappling with the difficult 409A issues, I find it really helpful to remind myself of the historical impetus behind 409A. It goes back to December 2001. Which is when Enron filed for bankruptcy. And in the weeks leading up to that bankruptcy filing, Enron allowed approximately 126 highly compensated employees to receive early distributions from their non-qualified deferred compensation accounts. And that totaled more than $53 million US dollars. So what that meant was that executives were allowed to defer tax on their income, but also they maintained control over the money that they had in these deferred compensation accounts. And that should raise an alarm bell if you're familiar with any tax regime. Meanwhile, around $435 million US dollars that remained in Enron's deferred compensation accounts for ordinary employees were frozen, and the employees became unsecured creditors of Enron behind secured creditors. So it was that scandal that prompted the US Congress to introduce 409A, which essentially introduced strict payment requirements as a condition for tax deferral arrangements. So what 409A essentially does is to restrict employees' ability to accelerate payment and to decide when and how to receive benefits and to pay tax on that income. So there are restrictions on things like initial deferral elections, permissible payment events, ability to accelerate payments, and there are also rules relating to deferral. The thing about 409A is that it can really capture a wide range of arrangements. We can immediately think about equity grants, but also 409A has implications in relation to severance arrangements, payment in lieu of notice, and even tax support. It also has broad jurisdictional reach in that it applies to all U.S. tax residents, so not just U.S. citizens, passport holders, but also green card holders, and not just those that are based in the U.S., but also those that are based in the U.K. as well.
As you say, 409A sort of infects all of the executive compensation arrangements for U.S. taxpayers, so I'm sure we'll come back to it as we carry on this conversation. But thinking about different elements of the reward package, what are the key differences between the UK and the US approach on those items that you've talked about? And in particular, maybe we start with equity grants.
We're going to come back to 409A right now, because 409A means that in the US, equity grants are usually structured as either market value options or restricted stock units, whereas in the UK, we wouldn't see market value options as often. Nil-cost options are much more common, along with RSUs or conditional awards. But there are also non-409A-related differences when it comes to equity awards. In the UK, for executive directors, we'd normally expect their equity awards to be 100% performance-based. We'd very rarely see time-based awards, whereas time-based awards are much more prevalent in the US. And if we think about performance period or vesting period, in the UK, usually awards cliff vest at the end of the vesting period, which is around 3 years, whereas in the US, vesting in installments, so over the course of the vesting period, it's much more common. And for listed companies, we'd normally expect executive directors' equity awards to be subject to an additional 2-year holding period after the 3-year vesting period. Whereas in the US, holding periods are definitely not as common. Although we should note that a small but growing number of public companies have started implementing relatively short, around 1-year holding periods. Related to holding periods is stock ownership guidelines, which is common in both jurisdictions for listed companies. The distinction there is that whereas in the UK, we'd normally expect listed companies that are subject to the corporate governance code to have post-cessation stock ownership guidelines, we would not normally expect to see that in the US.
So one of the other differences that I commonly hear remarked upon is that the UK has a strong drive to encourage executives to defer cash compensation into equity. So in lots of organisations, there is either an expectation or in fact a requirement that a proportion of somebody's annual bonus will be deferred into an equity award and then can't be realised for another 2-3 years.
Whereas in the US, again, with the more liberal approach to things, deferral would be more commonly at the executive's election, subject to 409A.
Always subject to 409A.
When it comes to securities law requirements, equity plans that operate in the US need to comply with state blue sky filings if there's no US listing. Whereas in the UK, we would normally expect equity plans to be exempt from prospectus requirements. And I think the lever treatment is probably an area where a lot of companies and participants focus on. In that respect, the lever treatment in the US is probably less participant friendly. In the UK, we normally expect good levers, unvested awards, to vest on the original vesting date, subject to time prorating, whereas bad levers, unvested awards, would normally be forfeited. In the US, in contrast, the default position would be that all participants, whether good or bad levers, forfeit both their vested and unvested awards. Sometimes executives get good lever treatment, and what that means is that good lever executives get to keep their vested awards, but they would still normally lose unvested portion, or sometimes they would have a portion of their unvested awards vest early. So leavers definitely get more favorable treatment in the UK than in the US. I think the circumstances of the good leaver category are fairly comparable in both jurisdictions, except for some of the different employment law concepts like redundancy and good reason.
So we'll come on to talk about the sort of end of employment arrangements and how those look different. But just picking up on what you were saying about vesting schedules, one of the things I've seen for sure is that vesting by installment, which is very normal in the US, it is becoming increasingly common in the UK as the UK is competing with US companies and looking at how the pay structures are different between the two regimes. So as I said, let's turn to leavers and severance and employment arrangements. Looking at that from a UK perspective, it's pretty common for senior executives to have 12-month notice periods in their employment contracts. And typically, those contracts will also include an ability for the executive to be paid in lieu of their notice. Now, there's a degree of variation in how that payment in lieu is calculated. Is it base salary only? Does it include benefits? Is there an amount for pension contribution? What happens in respect of bonus? But the executive will have some form of pile-on payment so that if they don't work their full 12-month notice period, they will get some form of monetary compensation for that. That obviously contrasts with the US experience where employment at will is much more the norm. And I think that's where severance arrangements step in and fill the gap. And Regina, maybe you can comment in a second on those. But just before doing that, I think, again, 409A coming back to haunt us, it's worth people remembering that where you have a standard UK employment contract that's got a payment in lieu of notice clause in it, and there's the ability to choose between a lump sum payment and a payment in instalments, that can give rise to 409A problems if you've got an executive who is a US taxpayer, even if they are living and working in the UK.
Yeah, it's definitely a point that some companies trip over, especially because sometimes companies don't necessarily realize that their executives are US taxpayers. So a point to bear in mind. To your point about the U.S. severance practices. As you mentioned, severance protection that's not related to changing control is much more common in the U.S. than in the U.K. But I think that's largely because of the at-will nature of employment in the U.S. with a short or no notice period that needs to be provided by the employer. And when severance is provided, that would typically be in the range of 1 to 2 times the sum of salary and target bonus. Similarly, in connection with changing control events, we normally expect to see, on top of early payout of equity awards and bonus, for senior executives, there would be additional changing control severance that normally be at 1 to 3 times the sum of salary and target bonus. That's very unusual in the UK. A nerdy point that I wanted to flag here as we're discussing severance and payment in lieu of notice pylon is that between severance and pylon, they're very similar, but there's a subtle but interesting distinction between the two concepts. And I think that arises from the fact that severance and pylon come from different philosophical starting points. And when I think about pylon, payment in lieu of notice, I think about an amount that's paid to the departing employee for the services that they would otherwise have rendered. So it's very much related to the service element, i.e. what they earned or not earned. Whereas when I think about severance, I think about it as additional termination benefits. It's almost like a perk. So I think that explains why pylon would normally consist of salary only, going back to your point about what elements are taken into account for a calculation of pylon, whereas in the US, severance amounts would be typically more generous in that the amount would include a bonus as well as salary. Another set of similar but subtly different concepts across the pond is the term good reason and constructive dismissal. In the US, good reason termination is a common provision which is defined carefully to fall within the 409A safe harbor. But in the UK, it's not usually a concept that would be contractually defined, and employees would instead need to rely on the concept of constructive dismissal or unfair dismissal. So what that means is that if an executive quits because of, for example, a change in their job title, then in the US, they would be able to get contractual severance protection under the good reason termination provision. But in the UK, they would need to resign and possibly get pylon if they don't serve the full notice period or bring a claim, but there'd be no assurance of a good leaver treatment there.
And I think that is one of the challenges for UK companies who are looking to recruit individuals who are used to the US environment, because they are presented with an employment package, which is sort of the market norm in the UK, but which on the face of it provides much less by way of assurance and protection around what happens in a termination scenario. And I think it is worth companies remembering that when they are looking to hire people who may not be familiar with the UK environment, that there may need to be a certain amount of education about what the package will look like, how it's going to work in a termination scenario. And in some cases, it may be appropriate to be pointing incoming executives towards their own advisors, both lawyers who can review the documentation from a contractual perspective, but also potentially remuneration consultants who can provide some assurance about the package being normal and in line with market standards.
There's definitely a fundamental cultural and also historical difference between the two countries. So when I think about the US employment arrangement, it's very much driven by bilateral contractual arrangements, hence the more generous provisions. Whereas in the UK, I think there's just a lot more statutory employment protection mechanisms, which is why we don't need to rely so much on more generous employee pay packages.
So we've talked about equity arrangements, we've talked about employment contracts and severance arrangements. I just wanted to touch on, I suppose it's really part of equity arrangements, but it's a slightly different permutation of it, which is true share ownership. So management incentive plans where management teams are actually acquiring shares, or other arrangements where employees are given the opportunity to invest directly in shares in the company they're working for. I think it's probably fair to say that the distinctions between the US and the UK side are less with those kind of structures. The aim in both scenarios, both sides of the pond, is that employees are subject to capital gains tax treatment, that these are treated as an investment, and that they attract lower tax rates as a consequence. Coupled with that, again, in both situations, is the fact that the employee is being asked to invest their own funds in these arrangements. The US does see a bit more variation. In some ways, despite 409A being so difficult, there is more flexibility in some of the taxing provisions that mean that other structures are potentially available. So we do see profits interests and sometimes market value options used as alternatives to traditional MIP arrangements. And subject to valuation points, where again, you find that you get a different answer if you do a valuation for US tax purposes versus if you do a valuation for UK tax purposes. Subject to those valuation points, it's relatively easy to bring a US executive or a US taxpayer into a traditional UK MIP structure. What can sometimes be harder, and again, it depends on which structures you're looking at in the US, is doing the reverse and taking a UK executive into a US structure, particularly a structure that is treated as a sort of transparent partnership for tax purposes in the US.
I guess a question that companies with global executive bases have to grapple with is how to structure their equity arrangements so that they can accommodate their UK and US executives and perhaps Australian and, you know, other countries as well.
And sometimes those problems are insoluble. So if I come back to the UK versus US valuation issue, they are just fundamentally different approaches that the tax authorities take as to how you value equity. And so you can end up with some seemingly very perverse results where you've got executives in one jurisdiction who are having to pay X for their shares and executives in another jurisdiction who are having to pay considerably more for their shares in order to make the structures work from a tax perspective, which is clearly, when you're looking at things on a global basis, far from ideal.
Yeah, and the question definitely becomes a little bit easier if you are dealing with very senior executives who are US and UK based. But if you have more lower ranking employees, then, you know, how far do you go to accommodate all the differences? I think that's been a fairly comprehensive coverage of all the structural and technical drivers behind the US and UK executive compensation practices. And it's a good reminder that the discrepancies are more than just a quantum. Having said that, though, of course, there's the big elephant in the room, which is the dollar or sterling figures that get reported on, especially in the listed company context. I think that a lot of it, i.e. the quantum, is driven by the level of investor scrutiny that is afforded by the listed company regimes in the two countries, in combination with the general cultural differences in the two countries when it comes to pay that we see across sectors and the society as a whole.
So moving to look at disclosure, and I suppose this is really more of a public company point, but what are the key differences, Regina, from your perspective, between the disclosure and shareholder approval regimes in the UK and the US?
I think a lot of the difference comes from whether the regime is backward-looking or forward-looking and whether the regime is binding or advisory. In the US, the disclosure regime on executive compensation is more backward-looking. So you look at the historic compensation and the shareholder vote in respect of that is advisory. In the UK, it's completely different. So there's the remuneration policy regime. That is, companies need to get binding shareholder vote at least every 3 years, with any payment that's outside of the shareholder-approved policy being unenforceable. So it's much more forward-looking, and also it's much more restrictive in that companies' ability to pay their executives, especially trying to recruit those who come from the US market, who are used to bigger packages, are bound by the four corners of the shareholder-approved policy that may have put in place 2 years ago. Having said that, though, the scope of the disclosure is slightly broader in the US in that it covers a pool of the so-called named executive officers, and that's usually 5+ people, whereas in the UK, the regime is limited to directors, including normally 2 executive directors.
So I think when you look at the UK and the US regimes, there's so much that seems familiar between the two of them. And actually, that's what makes it so difficult, because everybody thinks they're talking the same language, but in fact, they're not. And it's very easy for people to have crosswired, get confused, and there to be misunderstandings between companies and the executives they're looking to hire, because they're coming at things from ideologically different places. So yes, there is an ongoing debate about competitiveness. Is the UK competitive compared to the US? That is focused on pay levels, but actually it is important to remember that that debate should focus on other aspects of pay arrangements, including the structures that are typical in each jurisdiction. It's clearly a debate that's going to run for some time. We've seen the Investment Association in the listed company space come out and give some indication that they're going to revisit their guidelines, recognising the competitive pressures that the UK is under as it looks to compete for talent with the US. But it's also just worth remembering that compensation systems, which are designed to operate on a global basis for a global workforce, will need to be able to flex to reflect the individual executives who are most critical to companies, and that actually a one-size-fits-all approach won't always work. Thank you, Regina. I'm conscious that this series is called The Rewarding Half Hour, and I think we are coming up to our time. So I don't know whether you've got any final remarks that you'd like to make.
I guess one takeaway point that I want to leave with is that the debate around UK and US pay practices doesn't just come out of a vacuum, and we need to understand it in the broader societal context, as well as all these technical factors that we discussed during the session.
Thank you for listening to us. We hope you found it interesting and informative. We also hope you'll look out for our other episodes in the Rewarding Half Hour series. In the meantime, if you have any questions or would like any support with any of the things that we've discussed, please reach out to Regina or me, or to any of your usual Freshfields contacts.